Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
But first, Vice President Dick Cheney has announced he will speak tonight about this past weekend's hunting incident. The Vice President has granted an interview to Fox News to air at 6 p.m. The 78-year-old man shot by Vice President Dick Cheney is back in intensive care after suffering a minor heart attack yesterday. While the hunting accident continues to provide fodder for late-night comics, some senior Republicans are now saying it's caused serious damage to the White House by reinforcing Mr. Cheney's image as secretive and unaccountable. Peter Baker is a White House reporter for The Washington Post. He joins us from his office. And Peter, by the way, I said accident. There are some people saying it's a reported accident. We're really not even sure because there hasn't been a real investigation. And I don't know if there are any precedents here, but as far as you can tell, how unusual is it that after a shooting, you know, a vice president doesn't make a public comment?
Well, there are so many good questions in there. It's hard to even know where to start. As for was an accident, I mean, you know, the sheriffs in Kennedy County, Texas, told our reporter there yesterday that he's concluded it's an accident. So that's the way he's treating it at the moment. You know, some people make a distinction, I guess, between accident and, you know, something in which you unintentional. So there's, I suppose, that debate about liability or that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But in any case, obviously it's the talk of the town here in Washington. There are Republicans who are worried about the way this plays out to the public at large. And it's very hard to imagine a politician being in an incident like this and going, 3-4 days, without coming out making a public statement before Vice President Cheney's interview on Fox this afternoon.
Now, we're reading that this incident also seems to have revealed a rift between the staffs of the president and the vice president.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is traditional to some extent. Every White House has some tension between the president's people and the vice president's people. They've always said in this White House it's less because this vice president doesn't want to run for president later, so he doesn't have his own agenda, his own ambition. But I think you're starting to see increasingly some tension there even in this White House because the president's staff doesn't know how to handle a vice president who doesn't want to do the things they want him to do, such as issue statements when news comes up and respond to public interest on, you know, obviously a pretty big story.
We hear reports of White House aides, you know, pulling aside reporters and whispering, we would have done it differently. You know, is there a sense that even though Cheney might choose this attack because he's not interested in running for president, that this may become a problem for the president?
Well, it certainly, you know, it distracts from the things he'd rather talk about today. He's in Ohio. He's talking about health savings accounts, part of his State of the Union agenda. My guess is it's not going to be the main thing on the evening news tonight. It's a problem for the president in the sense that, you know, having your vice president be the butt of late-night jokes, obviously, you know, compromises his ability to go out and sell the program. So it's not the kind of thing the Republicans wanted to happen, especially given how rough a year the Bush White House had in 2005.
Well, given that, Peter Baker, I mean, that reminds us, you know, Dick Cheney was off hunting. So one wonders, do you read that Cheney's power in the administration might have all been weakened by some of those problems, the indictment of his chief of staff in the CIA leak case, for instance?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly the belief of a lot of Republicans, that he doesn't wield quite the same dominant influence that he had in the first term, that all of this has started to catch up with him to some extent. It's hard to know. It's sort of a black hole, exactly, the relationship between President Bush and Vice President Cheney, and that's the only one that really matters. You know, the policies of the second term, particularly in terms of things like Iran and North Korea, certainly different than the types of approach he advocated with Iraq in the first term, as an example.
Peter Baker, White House reporter for The Washington Post, speaking to us from Washington. Peter, thanks so much.
Thank you. Appreciate it. Good talking to you.
Today, we begin an occasional series on elder care. As some of you know, my family had been caring for our mom for several years as she sank deeper into dementia. After she died over Christmas, we were struck by how many of you we heard from, caring for parents over long distances, in nursing homes, or in their own homes. Without insurance, the cost of nursing home care can be prohibitive. Many families are unwilling to sell a parent's home to pay for that care. And like us, many of you just wanted to help your parents stay in the family home.
My name is Karen Foley from Methuen, Massachusetts. We are going through much the same thing now with my mother, who is in the end stages of ALS, or Lou Gehrig's disease, and I fly out to Seattle every few months to relieve my sisters. And yes, one of us sleeps with her, the night shift, and one takes the day shift. We only catnap so we can hear if she has to get up in the night. Our signal is the clicking of the breathing machine mask as she tries to get it off. It's exhausting, but she makes it as good as possible by being grateful.
Karen's mom died last week. We also heard from Mary Jo Bennett, who wrote that until her mom passed away, she was regularly commuting from Bozeman, Montana to New York City to care for her. Scott Warner moved to Maine to care for his dad. He writes, "As I changed soiled diapers and lifted his unresponsive body, I learned more about him and myself than I had in 35 years. All of you were grateful for the opportunity to care for a parent, if overwhelmed. Here's Betsy Caruso.
We despaired of how to keep Mom at home and support Dad as her dementia deepened. Miraculously, Mom continued to be able to play her flute, translate from French, and read and write backwards and upside down. Mom didn't know whether I was her sister or her daughter, but she knew she was with people who loved her and whom she loved. A few days later, Mom slipped on the stairs. A true Downeaster, she could never be convinced to give up her old L.L. Bean sneakers, worn and slick though they were, and sat down hard on the stairs. She was x-rayed to rule out a fractured hip. The films revealed broadly metastasized bone and stomach cancer. In a few weeks, she was gone.
Well, we heard from listeners who spent as many as 12 years in round-the-clock care of elderly parents. So, joining us now is Eleanor Ginsler, an expert on elder care at AARP. She's going to help us begin our look at this issue of elder care. And Eleanor, can you start by putting this in perspective? I mean, obviously our hearts are broken, but people want to understand how to do this better. How many Americans are helping to take care of an elderly family member?
When AARP did its survey just about 2 years ago, we were looking for a number, and we ended up calculating that there are 33.9 million people taking care of somebody who is 50 years of age and older.
Well, and, you know, why is this different from back in the day? Because, for instance, my mom's mom, my grandmother, lived with us. I mean, what's different now?
The things that are different are that it's a far more complicated endeavor these days. Families have always cared for themselves, for their family members. There has been a commitment to do this. That commitment exists still today. Only now we have all sorts of complications like more women in the workplace, like families not living as close together as they used to.
You mentioned women. We got an enormous amount of mail from men taking care of their parents, but you say that women are part of the typical profile.
Yeah, the typical profile still is a woman. I am delighted to report that when we did our research, it looks like men are pitching in at a lovely rate. The breakdown gender-wise is that about 39% of caregivers are male and 61% of male of caregivers are female. That's still a lot of people of both male and female that are engaged in this kind of behavior.
Well, I've spoken of my mom here because I wanted to share what I was learning. And one of the things that was most mind-boggling was how federal support through Medicaid, for instance, varies from state to state. What do you recommend that people learn as they realize they're going to be a caregiver?
There are an enormous number of people walking around who think, I don't need to worry about long-term care for my parent because they're on Medicare. Well, guess what? Medicare does not cover a long-term stay in a nursing home, for example. And you have identified it is Medicaid, which is the insurance program for the impoverished, that is our public payer source of long-term care in our country. You have to understand it. You have to know it. You have to know how it works in your specific state, and it's going to be different from state to state, as you've identified.
How is this affecting? I mean, it's obviously affecting people, but how does it affect the workforce?
Oh, yeah, there's an immense bottom line, dollar bottom line to American businesses that sometimes is not identified. There has been some research done in the not-too-distant past that looked at what is the cost to corporate America for lost productivity because of elder care issues. The range was anywhere from $11 billion to $29 billion a year. When people are not able to come to work or they leave work completely and then they have to hire new people and recruit them and train them, or while I'm at work, I'm really not functioning at a high enough level because I'm so distracted because I have so much on my mind.
Yeah, the amount of phone calls one makes in the course of a day at work are mind-boggling. Well, the Family Medical League Act allows people who work at companies with 50 or more employees to take time off to care for a loved one, but you don't get paid. You see people actually losing their jobs?
Yeah, we do have that. People have made a decision to leave the workforce because they just can't figure out how to balance it. Close to 10% of the caregivers we talked to stopped working. Also, people making decisions going from a full-time position to a part-time position. Also, people making decisions to take a job that is a lower-level job and not seek promotional opportunities. It affects their own earning power as well as the bottom-line dollar of the company.
I can hear people saying, why not just place mom or dad in a nursing home? And that might at some point be the most wonderful place for them, but they may not understand. It costs $8,000 to $10,000 a month, I believe, in most nursing homes.
Yeah, it does depend upon where you live, but the cost of nursing homes is exceptionally high. And nursing homes, we all know, provide exceptionally important care, but only for a small percentage. At any one point in time, there are about 1.4 million residents in the nursing homes in our nation. There are about 12 million people who need care, assistance with their activities of daily living. They have, disabilities and they are in need of assistance. You know, if we lived in a much more perfect world, we would have a long-term care system in our country that included payment and that was nationalized and did not expect people to become impoverished before they became eligible for long-term care assistance.
Well, Eleanor, with that in mind, I want to ask you about a project we're about to take a look at. It's called the Beacon Hill Village. It's here in Boston in a kind of an upscale neighborhood where people 50 years and over pay dues, and in return they get cared for and sort of the promise that they can stay in their homes. What does AARP think of the Beacon Hill Village?
I think that these are very creative ways to address the issue that we know exists, that people want to stay where they're living for absolutely as long as they can and have their needs met in their setting of their choice, which is the house that they've been living in or the community they've stayed in.
Do you really think that the Beacon Hill Village project can be transferred to other communities? Because Beacon Hill is a rather wealthy neighborhood, and some of the participants in the program have donated huge amounts of money to help the program grow.
I think it's important to take the example that's going on in Beacon Hill and adapt them to the communities around the United States. Mm-hmm. There's even federal money right now that's out there that can be tapped into if you are what is called a naturally occurring retirement community, NORC. We call it a NORC, and it's because enough of the population has gotten older and needs assistance. There's even some federal funds to help you with care coordination.
Eleanor Ginsler, a national expert on elder care issues. Eleanor, thanks for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
And just ahead, we're going to take a closer look at Beacon Hill Village. It's actually a grassroots neighborhood effort to help the elderly stay in their homes in these neighborhoods. And also, on the other end of the age spectrum, just a reminder later in the program, young women aiming to clean up hip-hop. It's all coming up here and now. Stay with us. Population and what families are doing to help take care of their older loved ones. We just heard from Eleanor Ginsler of the AARP. Now, she said there's federal money available for seniors who band together in old age. Well, now we want to take a look at an innovative program where older people are doing just that, relying on each other. It's called the Beacon Hill Village. It's actually, though, a network of residents here in the Boston area who pay annual dues in exchange for help that enables them to live in their own homes instead of being forced to move into nursing homes or assisted living. For instance, they are taken on shopping trips.
All ready. Now you take your time.
Hold my cane.
I got your cane.
Twice a week, a Beacon Hill Village employee picks up members, including Dorothy Weinstein, for a trip to the grocery store.
Ready for takeoff.
I'm 97 years old. I'm on Beacon Hill 53 years. And I pray for 53 more.
Why don't you wait here for me?
Oh, yes.
And I'll be right back.
Emma Donnellan is one of several drivers.
I ask them if they want any help, and they like their independence. So they go about, and I pull up outside, load up the groceries, and then I unload the groceries for them. That's mostly the only help they need. But then sometimes I get a list, and they don't come with me, and I just buy the groceries and bring them back. So let's go look for this cereal.
This service is a lifeline for people like Dorothy who can live on their own with a little help. Too often, small daily tasks such as taking out the garbage, climbing a ladder to change a light bulb, or managing money can send an elderly person into a retirement home. But for an annual fee of around $550 for individuals and $780 for a household, Beacon Hill Village offers help with these tasks and more.
My life dictated that I had to join because of the shopping, mainly, where we our market went closed up. And it was hell to get shopping done.
Half a pound are these.
Fine.
That's
fine. It cost me a buck.
Can I see your list? What's on your list here?
Beacon Hill Village arranges rides to the doctor, provides exercise classes and lectures, brokers discounts for home repairs or home health aides. But sometimes companionship is the most important service.
Generally, it's the only thing that gets me out of the house. Because, well, I do have a walking companion. There, too, that Beacon Village sent this lovely lady to me. She volunteers to come once a week. I accomplish a couple of errands at the stores. And it's very nice. It's company for me, and also I get out.
I have my Stop and Shop card if you want.
No. I want mine because you earn credits.
Frequent flyer miles.
Where would I go that I would be as content as I am in my own beautiful home right now?
$12.10.
So I stay where I am, God willing. Okay, madame. Thank you.
Have a nice day.
You too.
Well, joining us in the studio now are the executive director of Beacon Hill Village, she's Judy Willett, and the group's president and co-founder, 72-year-old Susan McWinnie Morse. And Susan, let's start with you. How did this get started?
A group of us got together, Robin, about 6-7 years ago. There were 12 of us, actually, to sit and talk about the fact that we loved our neighborhood and we didn't want to leave, and how are we going to stay? How are we going to stay not only in our own homes, but make ourselves feel quite secure in making that choice? And we went from there. And the idea grew to include the community that we were in. We felt that that was a very important measure.
Does it take anyone of a certain age who wants to belong?
Our criteria is that people have to live in our central area, and which is central Boston, and you have to be 50 years and over.
Well, I mean, it sounds, Judy, the way communities should work, but often don't. I mean, it also sounds as if the younger members, you know, might put in as volunteers, but then 30 years from now, they may be the recipients of that kind of help.
Yes, but you have to remember one of the unique things across the country about Beacon Hill Village is that our people in their 50s, 60s, 70s, healthy 80s, they join Beacon Hill Village for many different reasons. We provide our members with one-stop shopping, and it's concierge services, which is information and referral, etc. We build community, and Susan speaks to that beautifully, and we also provide home health services.
We should say that although Beacon Hill is not a gated community by any means, but it's a rather elite neighborhood, and some of your founders are millionaires who donated, you know, seed money to get everything started. Do you think this program really can be transferred to other urban areas?
Yes, definitely. You can set this program up in many different ways. And from your neighborhood, knowing what kinds of things you need, doing a market survey, individual communities will set it up as the variation that works for them. We've had calls and emails from over 1,000 different nonprofits, for-profits, neighborhood groups across the country. And basically, they want to know, Can they replicate it? Mm-hmm. What can they do? Is there one in their community? Because people basically want to stay in their homes the rest of their mm-hmm. lives.
Do you worry that, though, that in doing this and doing it successfully, you may be actually taking the responsibility away from the government where some responsibility should be? Tell me why you're laughing.
Well, I'm laughing partly because we get that question asked all the time, and we're not trying to replicate anything. We're trying to create a new approach.
Yeah.
And where do you go if you live on $45,000 a year? Where do you go? And you don't drive and you don't have a car. Can you move to one of the far-flung suburbs? No, you are really stuck in the city.
Have you ever gotten to the point when one of the members can't stay in their home, either because they're, you know, sliding into dementia or you don't think it's safe? I mean, people would worry about liability issues.
We have had a few members, a few who have chosen to move to assisted living because that has been a better option for them, but very few. And one or two who we've worked with their family, and dementia has been the thing when they've moved into advanced Alzheimer's, that it was more appropriate for them to be in a more secure setting.
Well, we've been speaking with Susan McWinney Morse. She's the president and co-founder of Beacon Hill Village, and the group's executive director is Judy Willett. I want to thank you both for coming in to talk to us.
Very nice. Thank you, Robin.
Thank you so much.
And remember, this is just the first in our occasional series on elder care. There are many, many more problems and many innovative solutions that we'd like to explore down the road, and we will do that. So stay tuned for that. And stay here. Much more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from WBUR Boston, where the program's
first Democratic election since President Jean-Bertrand Aristide was ousted in 2004, is calling for a review of election results, complaining of voter fraud, including thousands of marked ballots found in a garbage dump. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of frontrunner René Préval's supporters have been demonstrating in Port-au-Prince, burning tires and littering debris around the city. At least one person has been killed. Kathy Klarich is covering Haiti for Time magazine. She's also the author of Madame Dread. That's her memoir of the decades she lived and worked in Haiti. And she joins us on the line from Miami. Kathy, welcome.
Thanks so much.
We understand that the interim government is promising a quick review of the election results. Is it thought, though, that that review process will be honored?
Well, I think that there's tremendous concern about the whole counting process. You know, elections got off to a very chaotic start, and I think people were incredibly worried that the voting day would have problems. But by the end of the day, you know, people were just thrilled. There was this massive turnout, and it looked as though maybe Haiti would finally be getting on the right track. So all of these problems with counting of the ballots indicates a much, I think, deeper concern that people have that their vote will be respected. And so the longer it takes, I think the more concern we have for a peaceful transition.
Well, and also we understand there are local television news pictures of white ballot boxes that were found in a garbage dump.
Yeah, the process was that the boxes were transparent in an effort to avoid fraud. There were several dozen, and I don't know the exact number, polling stations that were trashed. And so the UN is trying to say, well, this might be, you know, a result of those specific voting places. But I think it's probably indicative of a much larger fraud going on, trying to remove some of the ballots from René Préval.
People could see on these television pictures that these wads of ballots that were, you know, strewn in this garbage dump seemed to be marked for René Préval. But we thought he was clearly the front runner. Is it a closer race? Why would he be calling for a review?
Well, it's a very close race. He needs to win 50% plus one vote in order to avoid a runoff, which is scheduled for March 19th. The initial results that were coming in had him over 60%, and then his votes continued to drop, where the number 2, 3, and 4 didn't really change that much. So right away, there was some real concern. The other concern is that the number of nullified votes and blank votes are counted in the total percentage, which also lowers Préval's percentage. Those two things combined, the nullified votes, the ones that weren't marked correctly, and the blank votes, are actually larger than the second place runner-up.
So now we have this call for a review. And the review process itself, how will that go about?
Well, this is also a big concern because I'm not sure that they have an accurate system in place. The government last night announced that they would put a commission together to look at this. It would be made up of a member of the interim government, which no one respects, the Provisional Electoral Council, which no one respects, and then someone from Prevost's party, which obviously is an impartial person. So already the system that they're setting up doesn't seem to be a very good one.
In the meantime, you know, there is an interim government, as we said, but Preval has the support of a lot of the poorer population in Haiti, and they're very angry now that, you know, feeling that their voice might not be heard. We mentioned there's chaos in the streets, people burning tires, erecting barricades. We know that UN armored vehicles went around trying to clear the streets. What were they doing?
Well, they were trying to clear the streets, but I think it has to be mentioned that Preval made a very presidential and statesman-like speech yesterday, saying to his supporters, look, you have the right to demonstrate. You're defending your right to vote, but do it peacefully. Allow schools to open. Allow traffic to go, you know, to circulate freely. And people went home. They took to the streets again last night when it was discovered that these ballots had been trashed. So I think he's taking a very smart approach, asking for calm, but understanding that people do feel, if he's not approved in the first round, that their vote has been stolen again. And obviously there's a history, because twice they voted for President Aristide and twice he was forcibly removed from office.
We've talked to you about this before, removed by Haitians.
Removed by Haitians in the first one was a military coup, and then again, the second one is these very unclear circumstances where Aristide said he was kidnapped by the international community, and that's disputed, obviously, by certain sectors in the Haitian society.
What about René Préval? He's been president before. What is the international thinking about René Préval as leader of Haiti?
Well, I think they didn't want him, quite honestly, but with the kind of support that has been shown by the Haitian people, they're going to have to deal with him, and they're going to have to deal with his popularity. And I think he has also made it very clear that he is not the person that he was when in between the two Aristide tenures. He's independent. He's run on his own party. He's not beholden to Aristide the way that he was before. And so I think how he deals with the Americans is also going to be a very interesting challenge for him.
Reporter Kathy Claridge. And Kathy, I just want to ask you your personal observations, because we know you just came back from Haiti. And we've spoken to you before. You wrote your memoir, Madame Dread, about your life living in Haiti, married to a Haitian drummer, Jean Raymond. What is your personal sense of what's happening?
Oh, you know, Robin, I have to say, after last week's vote, I had two reactions. I was just overwhelmed by the support that I saw of people coming out to vote and how dignified they were in taking their responsibility peacefully and asking for change. But I also was really sad that the conditions under which they voted were so pathetic. I mean, I just can't describe how awful some of the settings were where people had to vote. And that, you know, here it is 20 years after the fall of Duvalier, and the basic lifestyle of the average Haitian has not improved. And really hopeful that this election would have started them on the right path. And now with this all of this brouhaha about the results, I feel like we're slipping back a little bit.
Kathy Claridge, currently covering Haiti for Time magazine and also author, as we said, of the memoir Madame Dread, about her decades of living in Haiti. And Kathy, you just ended on a kind of despondent note. Do you think next time we talk it'll be about a second round of voting or about an inauguration?
Well, I certainly hope that there will be a second round, and that will be for the parliamentary runoffs. And let's hope that there's not a presidential runoff and that we'll be talking after March 29th about the inauguration of the new government.
Kathy, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, as always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on the program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line. You can leave us a message at 617-358-0397. Again, that's 617-358-0397. Please remember to tell us how to pronounce your full name and tell us the town you're from. Well, still to come, the black female readers of Essence magazine are looking to clean up hip-hop. You're listening to Here and Now. Starting later this month, the Chicago Mercantile Exchange will begin trading snowfall futures, contracts based on how much snow falls in Central Park in New York and Logan Airport here in Boston. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which started out as the Chicago Egg and Butter Board back in 1898, says these snowfall futures could help retailers whose businesses are affected by the weather or cities struggling to keep up with snow removal costs hedge their risks. Snowfall futures join a growing field of what are known in the investment business as weather derivatives, and here to explain them to us is Felix Carabello. He's Director of Alternative Investments for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, or CME. He's speaking to us from London. And Felix, these future markets for snowfall weren't in play last weekend when the East Coast got hit with more than a foot of snow. So how could a city like New York take advantage of these snowfall futures next winter?
The city of New York in the future will be able to, once they go through their snowfall budget and snow exceeds, let's say, a certain number, let's say it's 3 feet, then the marketplace will pay the city of New York for every inch that it snows.
Because New York did what?
Because New York bought an option to buy the index at a certain number.
Oh.
So, for example, let's say New York says, okay, the 10-year average snowfall for New York City is, let's say, roughly 20 inches. So fine. So we will budget for snow removal 20 inches. In fact, Mayor Bloomberg back in 2003 said that it costs the city about $1 million an inch to remove snow. And so above 20 inches, you have no budget. But if you buy the index at 20, for example, then anything above that, then the marketplace will pay you back depending on how many contracts you have. That you've purchased.
Well, let's say the city of New York guessed it would be 20 inches or bought 20 and they only got 15. What happens then?
They reap the difference. So there was 5 inches worth of snow that they didn't have to pay for. So they have extra funds in their budget. Now, the unfortunate thing is they, of course, paid for the right to be paid above 20. But given that, obviously, the market, you know, if you don't go there, then you're not going to get paid, but you still benefit because what you're doing is you're bringing the future to the present.
Why is futures moving in this direction? Because we know traditionally it's been mostly about agricultural products, cattle and pork and milk and butter.
In the early stages, the CME was involved in trading physically delivered consumable commodities. Then we evolved into financial instruments that are cash settled. And now we are involved with trading events, right? So we're looking at, we trade temperature. We also now we're looking to trade snowfall. And in the future, we're gonna trade hurricane risk. So these are events that, although it's very difficult to grasp, still these events have considerable economic implications.
Felix Carabello, Director of Alternative Investments for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, CME, talking to us about the new snowfall futures, options that will be traded on the Merc, speaking to us from London. Have you had a lot of interest in this, Felix?
Well, we have, especially after Sunday. What's really fascinating is that the daily delivery of weather, you know, goes on all the time. And what we have a hard time grasping is the fact of, you know, what are the economic implications? And we think the future will be where the weatherman will become a financial analyst. So it should be where the meteorologist says, look, you know, we expect a much colder, or let's say much warmer than normal winter. That means that, you know, these companies will perform poorly if they're not hedged.
Right.
You know, retailers in the future will be able to use snowfall futures and options to hedge, you know, lack of foot traffic that's going through their door because of a snowstorm.
Felix Carabello is Director of Alternative Investments for the Chicago Mercantile Exchange, which will begin trading snowfall futures later this month. Stay with us. Much more ahead here and now. hip-hop has become the soundtrack for today's urban youth culture. It's also evolved into a powerful social force and a $4 billion a year industry. Major universities and colleges now include hip-hop studies in their curriculum, asking students to think critically about the genre that's been criticized for profiting from misogyny and glorifying violence. With that in mind, we should say what you're about to hear may be offensive. Here is some hip-hop music and some thoughts from students at Boston's Berklee College of Music.
I listen to Kanye West, Jay-Z, some of the more commercial stuff like Nelly. For the commercial stuff, I don't take that seriously.
It's more the beat in the club, you know, that you're dancing to than what it's actually saying, because I caught myself a few times dancing to some songs and I'm like, oh my goodness. When I actually listened to the words, I was like, oh no, never again. But the beat is like, it catches you.
So we're not trying to say everything needs to be, you know, parents just don't understand. The critical element of more hardcore rap is important, but I do think that there a lot of people are concerned about the things that are unbalanced in the popular culture spray right now.
That's Professor William Banfield, who teaches the Africana Studies class at Berklee College of Music. Berklee is co-sponsoring a songwriting contest with Essence Magazine. Just last year, Essence launched a campaign to raise awareness about how black women are portrayed in media, especially in urban music and music videos. Joining us now is Cynthia Gordy, assistant editor of Essence Magazine. Hi, Cynthia.
Hi, how are you?
Good. We also welcome Darcy Nicole Wicknick, co-founder of the Boston Hip Hop Alliance. Darcy, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
And Cynthia, I want to start with you. We understand that an incident at Spelman College, the historically black college for women in Atlanta, took place right as you were sort of crafting the Take Back the Music campaign. What happened at Spelman?
Nelly planned to visit the campus for a blood drive. So being a black women's college, some students had concerns about some of his lyrics, which they found offensive. And, you know, they definitely wanted to support the blood drive, but there was still this conflict.
And so, his videos, we understand.
His videos.
He swipes a credit card between a woman's buttocks in one, and that was upsetting to people.
Right, so they confronted that by planning a forum on misogyny and hip-hop, and they wanted him to speak with them about his lyrics. Nelly didn't want to do that. He didn't see why he should be confronted about his music since he was there for the blood drive. So he disinvited himself. No one from Spelman actually disinvited him. They didn't say he couldn't come. They just wanted to talk to him and express their reservations about some of his work. You know, we heard about that, and we saw that they were not being supported for speaking out against it. And in February, we held our first town hall at Spelman College, and it was a really impassioned dialogue that really brought home how hard-hitting the subject of misogyny in mainstream hip-hop music is.
Tell us, what were some of the things that people said?
They felt really hurt. And I want to make this really clear, that Take Back the Music is coming from a place of love. We're fans of hip-hop music. But, you know, sometimes when we hear ourselves constantly being demeaned, constantly having language used against us, or sometimes there's lyrics that actually seem to encourage physical abuse against women, it's hurtful. It's alarming, actually, because we know that there's so much more to hip-hop music, and there's whole other sides of music that aren't being heard. And we just are concerned about this abundance of one kind of image, that this is our main image out there.
Well, I want to bring in Darcy Nicole Wicknick, again, co-founder of the Boston Hip Hop Alliance, and also a journalist, Darcy, and a music management consultant. Do you have the same response to the lyrics?
Not all of the lyrics. I mean, certainly there are songs that I find to be extremely uncomfortable and lewd, but I would also express that happens, I think, across the pop culture.
And by the way, can you give me some examples?
As far as lewd examples,
mm-hmm.
There's quite a few. I'd rather not name names, but I definitely heard about the credit card song that Nelly did. Like I said, though, it shouldn't be hip-hop's burden to bear exclusively. I think that pop culture has a lot of impact on how women are portrayed in music and media as a whole.
Darcy, I can't imagine what it's like to work in hip-hop. I mean, I'm probably dating myself here, but, you know, just, you know, thinking of some of the lyrics, how do you look someone in the eye? I mean, it would seem like it'd be a weird work environment for a woman.
You know, as a music business consultant, I'm very cognizant of who I listen to, and also when, you know, artists come to me with their lyrics, I'll say, you know what? What are you saying here? And do you want to be remembered for the rest of your life for this song?
Mm.
You know, and that kind of stops people to think. You know, I say you have one chance to make a hit sometimes, and make sure you can stand by the one hit you get.
In the 80s, rock bands, for instance, objectified women. And hip-hop, though, at that time was emerging, you know, with lyrics about justice and street life. So when did that change?
I think back in the 80s, hip-hop was still a bit of a subculture. And I think back then there was a more diverse range of topics covered. But I think as hip-hop has become more commercial, the music is seen as more of a product with less emphasis on content and artistry. And because it sells, I think many record labels are sticking to this one formula with very little deviation.
I would also add to Cynthia's comment, I think there are people who have longevity who have managed to break those barriers, people like Common, newcomers like Talib Kweli, people like The Roots. I mean, there's people who have a lot of groundswell not in really the underground, but among the masses, that among people who in themselves are conscientious of social issues. And of course, another side of things is that the gospel hip-hop industry is exploding right now and putting a spiritual aspect into hip-hop and utilizing that as a vehicle to convey positive messages and positive lifestyles. So there's definitely two sides of the coin that I think should always be expressed.
I'm wondering, Cynthia, if you ever come across a young woman who may be, you know, a little combative about it, you know, this is her music, and then you see a moment where she actually hears it and hears how demeaning it is?
From the letters that we've received, I know that moment is happening in response to the campaign, in response to other activists, you know, around the country.
Well, what do they say in their letters?
Some of them have been from teenage girls who, you know, before they just go to a party and they just like the beat. They're not really paying much attention to the lyrics. But when they're encouraged to actually think about it, they sort of felt uncomfortable about it, and they felt, you know, some of them felt bad about it. Some of them felt like, why is this the way that I'm portrayed in my music? Hmm. So,
Cynthia, we also want to mention this songwriting contest that Essence is co-sponsoring with the Berklee School of Music. What are you hoping to get? Hip-hop that's kinder to women?
We're just looking for songs with lyricism that's innovative and clever, anything that's different from the norm. We just want to encourage people to be creative and be original and break out of the cookie-cutter formula.
That's Cynthia Gordy. She's assistant editor at Essence Magazine in New York. They're holding a songwriting contest as part of their Take Back the Music campaign to try to get women in particular to listen more critically to hip-hop music. I want to thank you for speaking to us.
Thank you very much.
Thank you for having us.
Darcy Nicole Wicknick is co-founder of the Boston Hip-Hop Alliance. For more information on the Take Back the Music campaign and new directions in music, visit our website, here-now.org. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
I want to be as free as the spirits of those who left. I'm talking Malcolm, Coltrane, my man Yusef. Through death, through conception, new breath and resurrection. For arms, new steps in that direction in the right way. Told this side is where the fight lay. And everything good nigga do may not be what he might say. Chicago night stay. Stay on the mind, but I write many lives. They lay on these lines, wait the signs of the times. Many say the grind's on the mind. Shorty's blinded out and everyone wanna rhyme. Bush pushing lies, killers immortalized. We got arms but won't reach for the skies. Waiting for the Lord to rise. I look into my daughter's eyes and realize I'ma learn through her.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software. On the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories.